resorts, homes, and a newly built hospital have been washed away.
Communication is down all over the country. Everybody was just rushing up to the closest high point.
I'm just holding on for dear life here.
Pacific prepared.
Pacific prepared.
Pacific prepared.
The warnings were going out. The extent to which people took heed of the warnings is another question.
Very much a wake-up call.
People were prepared, and that's why we've got less lives lost than we could have had.
People need to know what to do, and it's not difficult.
We provide the right information to people, and they can act accordingly.
Pacific kissing was.
Ke pasfiki genau mateu teu.
Kalt mokal Pacific.
Pacific, you feel I must prepare.
Pacific prepared.
Pacific prepared.
Hello, and welcome to Pacific Prepared, where the Pacific comes together to share information that can save lives, save loved ones, and save livelihoods. I'm Aaron Carney. Coming up this episode, using the power of nature to reduce the power of natural disasters. Households in Tuvalu becoming water wise. What to do after a bushfire. And Palau's ambitious multi-disaster warning system plan. Disasters may be inevitable, but the loss of your life, your family, your home, your land, or your village are not. So, let's prepare.
It was a terrifying night. Everything was shaking and getting pounded by debris.
We had to make sure that they have a safe shelter and drinking water.
Helping you stay safe, Pacific Prepared.
Natural disasters, as the name suggests, unleash nature's fury with terrible effect. But what if we could turn that around and use nature to reduce the amount of damage done by disaster? A project in the Solomon Islands has been attempting to do just that. The Secretariat of the Pacific Regional Environment Program's Pacific Ecosystems-Based Adaptation to Climate Change, or PEBAC, explores and promotes ecosystem-based adaptation options for adapting to climate change. Pacific Prepared Solomon Islands reporter Georgina Kakia makes sense of it all.
The physical environment and its makeup are very important to people's lives. As humans, we fully depend on the Earth's ecosystems to provide us with food, clean water, spiritual fulfillment, among others.
So our climate is changing so fast. The impacts are happening at different rates, and our ability to adapt in the different forms can result in different responses. So one of the solutions that people are looking at is that the natural environment has the ability to respond to changing climate conditions.
Fred Patterson used to be PEBAC Solomon Islands County Director. PEBAC explores and promotes conservation of natural resources as a means to adapt to the changing weather patterns brought about by the impact of climate change. In Solomon Islands, PEBAC focused on three demonstration sites: the Honera Botanical Garden, Wagina Community in Chuesol Province, and Barana Community Nature and Heritage Park in the outskirts of Honiara. Barana Community Nature and Heritage Park was formerly known as the Queen Elizabeth Park. Owned by the Barana Community, the park spans approximately 5,000 hectares of forest area in the upper catchment of the Mataniko River. Mataniko River is one of the largest catchments draining Honiara City. Today I am here at the Barana Nature and Heritage Park, and it is quite windy. I spoke to Melinda Key from Barana Village.
I would say the traditional way of gardening, we would say the best way to where a garden could be is right near a stream or water, so that it's cool and it's near to water the vegetables, without realizing that when you clear that area for your garden or your farm, you actually drown the water, or you're just minimizing the water will just the stream might even just die out. So now we know that from this initiative, we know that where we can have gardens.
The development of the Barana Park is part of SPREP's assistance to Solomon Islands under the PEBAC project. The Barana community was selected following an analysis and mapping study carried out in Honiara.
So the Barana community, we focus on the watersheds, because the Barana community lives on the mountain area, within the catchment. The watersheds have been hugely affected by themselves cutting down all the trees within the along the catchments, yeah, or the water sources. So what we were doing, trying to tell them, is you need to protect these specific areas, because these specific areas are important for your life. At the same time, we want to promote sustainable, as part of that includes sustainable land use. There are certain areas you can make your garden, there are certain areas you cannot. Now you will need to protect, for which the benefits are from the ecosystem services. And examples of ecosystem service is your access to water, your food, access to garden, good productive soil, I mean, you have good water, access to food, and also you maintain a balance in the environment. So the tangible effects is not as you expect to see. For example, if you build a big seawall where the sea doesn't come into your area. The ecosystem focus is a bit more long-term, but you are focusing on building the resilience of the natural environment that will in turn support community resilience.
The Barana community has a vision, which is to build resilience among the people through preserving and enhancing sustainable management of their natural resources, ecosystems, including the protection of their tradition, culture, history, and livelihood.
For Solomon Island, we have some of the most vulnerable in terms of small atolls and islands. And then a lot of our population lives on the coastal areas. And even if those who are living inland are vulnerable to changes in weather conditions, it affects health and other related issues. So there has to be a rethinking and reorganizing of not only the way we humans behave or the community behave, but also the way reorganizing the economy around a long-term approach that takes into account the impacts of climate change and maybe natural events and disaster.
Fred Patterson from the Solomon Islands, who used to be the SPREP's PBAC country manager. PBAC was a five-year project that explored and promoted ecosystem-based adaptation options for adapting to climate change. The project ended last year in Solomon Islands, but a PBAC Plus is coming soon.
10 minutes after the earthquake, we had a loud bang and then just saw the sea rising up.
Know what to do.
Know what to do.
Know what to do. Pacific Prepared.
In the last episode of Pacific Prepared, we heard that even as much of the Pacific braces for torrential rain in coming months, the tiny Polynesian nation of Tuvalu is trying to come to terms with a very different disaster, drought. We heard families crying out for further assistance and about a plan to educate and empower households to be water wise and ultimately drought proof. But how will that happen? Pacific Prepared reporter Shreya Kumar has been investigating.
Recording some of its lowest rainfall levels, the small Pacific island of Tuvalu has been facing drought for the past 5 months. With mounting concerns of water shortages, there are fears the communities would be hit hard by the climate extremes. The Red Cross Red Crescent Early Rainfall Watch places Tuvalu at dry warning level, with high risk of severe dry conditions getting worse. In a bid to help the communities, Tuvalu Red Cross are working alongside authorities to assist with household tank monitoring and delivering drought awareness activities. To support Tuvalu Red Cross with their drought early action, the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies have released emergency relief funds of around $33,000. Pacific Prepared caught up with Tuvalu Red Cross Society Acting Climate Change and Disaster Management Officer Tusi Finikaso to know more about the early action program.
Well, basically what Tuvalu Red Cross is doing now, we're collecting household information in family water usage, like how much water do they normally use in normal times, in say periods where there's a lot of water and periods where there's low rainfall, like what we're anticipating. Other information that we're collecting water harvesting collection statuses at each house, such as what are their gutters like, what are their water storage units like, including their water storage capacity. So what this will do, it will enable us, including the National Drought Committee here in Tuvalu, is to analyze household water usage that's collected in the surveys to determine what kind of approaches or interventions which can be done at household level. The reason for this is that we want households to have a more of a buy-in, like be more responsible for their water usage home and not to rely too much on the government or community water storage for their daily water meter.
What are the other authorities that have been weaved into this initiative?
Well, the National Drought Committee is headed by the National Disaster Management Office. Also included in this community is the Public Works Department Water Division, Tuvalu Met Services, the Island Council of Funafuti, the Climate Change Department, one project called the Live and Learn Project, and Tuvalu Red Cross. What the National Drought Committee does, it looks at the different possible interventions that each of the different committee members can do to help out the community members in times of drought or periods of low rainfall.
7 out of 9 islands in Tuvalu are part of the Tuvalu Red Cross Survey. They are Nanumea, Nanumanga, Niatau, Nui, Vetupu, Nukufetau, and Funafuti.
The reason that we chose 7 is that using our rainfall data from this year, 7 islands were more affected by spells of dry weather than the other 2 islands, so which is why we're only focusing on what? On 7 islands, which are the more populated islands out of the group.
Will there be any training programs which will be organized for the community members?
Yes. What we're also doing is we're developing drought standard operation procedures for the different island disaster committee members. So what we had in place before, for each of the different islands, we had like a before drought, during drought, and after drought stage. So now we've developed it into a little bit more detailed approach. So rather than saying before drought, we have different stages. So we have like a normal period, we have a drought watch period, drought warning, and a declaration of drought period. So we have more stages in which the different islands can plan their actions on, based on 2 different thresholds.
Does Tuvalu Red Cross, along with the other relevant authorities, plan to establish microclimate control strategies for longer sustainability?
Definitely. That's part of the longer-term strategy at the moment. So what we're doing right now is sort of collecting baseline information at household level, and then we're trying to see what approaches may or may not work based on the analysis of the household surveys that we're collecting at the moment.
What do you think would be the likely outcome of this surveys that has been going on?
So what we're hoping for, one of the outcomes of this survey, is to have a look at how families, like what are their water usage habits. So we're able to determine what kind of approaches that the National Drought Committee, or mainly us from Tuvalu Red Cross, how we can do interventions based on what is actually happening at community level at the moment. So we're hoping that we can see some trends on the different islands, and we can try and formulate an approach so people can use best practices on how they can conserve water.
The Tuvalu Red Cross team are currently reviewing all data and coordinating with Tuvalu Natural Disaster Management Office to analyze the impact of the dry period. Once completed, the team will identify possible sectors of intervention and islands which need support.
Pacific Prepared reporter Shreya Kumar outlining the effects of drought in Tuvalu and attempts to take a water-wise approach to surviving it. That was part 2 of that story. You can hear part 1 by heading to the Pacific Prepared page on the Radio Australia website, or simply type Pacific Prepared into your favourite search engine.
Helping you stay safe.
Pacific Prepared.
Even after a fire has burnt out, a number of dangers remain. Here are some tips to stay safe after bushfire. Make sure the fire has long gone and there is no danger of a flare before leaving your home or returning to it after evacuation. Wear protective clothing before entering a fire. Wear a face mask if possible. Keep children away. Houses, sheds, and other buildings or structures burned in a fire can leave potential health hazards like sharp objects, smoldering coals, damaged electrical wires, leaks, and weakened walls. If you have a septic tank, remember it may have been weakened in the fire, so do not drive or walk over it. Get rid of all foods that have been fire damaged or affected by heat. Likewise, medicines. Tank water can be contaminated in a fire. If water tastes, looks, or smells unusual, do not drink it. Stay hydrated with bottled or boiled water. If your home has been damaged by fire or smells of smoke, you should ventilate it by opening the house up to sunlight and fresh air to help remove the odor. Cooking utensils can be washed with detergent and hot water. Put smoke-affected beds and other furnishing outside in the sunshine and wind. Wash affected clothing normally and air dry outside. Disasters destroy lives, homes, and livelihoods. So prepare now. Include everyone. Make it fun. And be prepared. This information has been compiled from multiple official government and non-government agencies across the Pacific and the world.
TBC Tonga's Anasiu Falakayono, helping you know what to do after a bushfire.
Be informed.
Be ready.
Pacific prepared.
Imagine, no matter where you are, whether it is night or day, that as soon as a natural disaster threatened, you would get a warning. In the Micronesian nation of Palau, they're working on an ambitious all-purpose emergency siren system that would make that a reality. And it's just one technology to make us all more disaster ready. But even such comprehensive and sophisticated systems are no substitute for community cooperation and communication, as Pacific Prepared's Micronesia correspondent Bernadette Carrion discovered when she sat down with Palau National Emergency Management Office Executive Director Wyman Tuwai.
When we speak about the strengths of emergency response, it really correlates with the strengths of the country as a whole as far as development. As far as processes to ensure that coordination of emergency response, I think that we are really leading the region. Region I refer to the Pacific region. We often collaborate within the region and within the compact states of where we're at as far as coordination of emergency response. But again, the strength of emergency response is really reliant on the government, its priorities, and administration. Those all play a very vital variable in the whole equation. So if you'd allow me, the strength of the emergency response is really the National Emergency Committee, and that it's comprised of the executive branch of the government's directors, which really ensures that disaster response is a priority in all the agencies, and we really collaborate and collate together to respond. The weaknesses that we are working on currently is communication. I mean, communication. You can never have too many communication during emergency responses. You know, we plan that if all fails, you know, we have a backup to a backup. So right now, currently, what we're working on is a multi-hazard siren system throughout the entire country. The first siren system in Palau was a single siren system that was located in the downtown Koror on top of the Bureau of Public Safety. And that has long been obsolete. As the population starts to build towards the northern parts of the country, we find ourselves to really ensure that communication has to happen redundantly so everyone has access. So the multi-hazard warning system will be strategically located. 23 individual sites will be located throughout the country, with the exception of the Southwest Islands. Those will have a manual siren. And the manual siren will be supplemented by a 24-hour, 7 days a week HF high-frequency communication. So that way we can alert them to turn on the siren. But the ones here in the main island, including Koror, Peliliu, Angar, and Kayangal, will all and the entire of Babeldaob and Koror will all be remotely activated within the National Emergency Management Office. That's just another way of emergency communication. The weaknesses will always remain to be communication. Coordination. I mean, there's only so many ways that we can, you know, align ourselves to ensure that we are sharing information, real-time information. It also involves a lot of a relationship building with the media, with different types of media outlets, to, you know, really share the responsibility of alerting our citizens. So the current area that we're working on is really emergency communication.
You have also mentioned about the challenges. What if there's no technology? Can we still alert the people traditionally?
Yes, we can never do away with what you know, our forefathers or the grassroots did in their day. We relied on local people, actual human being, to run and alert the you know, the villages that if there's no power. We've been constantly trying to attack the state level, the community level way of coordination and emergency communication. We've done multiple fronts of awareness campaigns to organize themselves, not only in the state government level, but at the hamlet level. We've come up with a state disaster plan and we've come up with hamlet emergency plans to ensure that we speak the same language when it comes to emergency response. There will always be room to grow as we start to depend on development. For example, this fiber optic. Before, the radio station used to be the best and the only way to get information out to the rural communities. Now, I mean, Facebook is an example of a medium that has really taken over. Cable used to be another way for us to get, you know, push out information, but most households now are not opting for cable TV and on internet services like Netflix, you know, so our challenges remain constant and fragmented and continuously change. So that's another challenge, is that we need to keep up with the changes, but we have to hold on to the traditional way of doing things. So the very same project that's putting up the multi-siren system, we're also having a traditional knowledge portion of that to ensure the telltale signs of before, of how to predict or how to, you know, look at warnings that nature would give you as far as emergency preparation. There's that example of a spider web that's no longer there. The when the tides change or the birds, you know, there's a lot of traditional knowledge that goes on, goes into the how the ancestors used to kind of forewarn the villages. Those have been kind of formalized and put them in, and put in packages for the community. To the newer generations may not be as receptive or as informed as their ancestors. So these are the some of the redundant communications that I was referring to. That we rely on siren systems and remotely activating this and that But when all else fails, we would have to resort to traditional ways of doing things, the manual bells, the runners, the designated runners to warn a community here and there. Those are still very crucial to emergency response coordination. The best opportunity that I can see right now is this I guess, revitalized relationship with the media. I would very much like to be involved in, with the Media Council and how to better serve the community through the Media Council as far as what type of information is needed, how it's needed, when is it needed, so I can provide that information and hopefully rely on the support of the Media Council to assist us in informing their constituents or their listeners.
It proves once again everyone has a role to play and relationships are key. Traditional media presents a new opportunity. New technology provides new ways of getting messages out fast. Siren systems will save lives, but local action is critical. Pacific Prepared's Micronesia correspondent Bernadette Carrion with Palau National Emergency Management Office Executive Director Wyman Tuwai. We are now officially in cyclone season, and you should know if cyclone alerts are issued for South Pacific countries, our partner broadcaster RNZ Pacific will broadcast hourly updates of these bulletins if needed, and whenever the situation changes. These will be heard either just before the top of each hour or following news bulletins at the top of each hour. The information comes from the Nandi Met Office in Fiji, the New Zealand Met Service, and various other Pacific-based sources. If you know someone who can only get shortwave radio, check the RNZ website to discover the frequency for their area and let them know. Pacific Prepared is supported by the Pacific Media Assistance Scheme, with funding from the Australian Government's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Any views expressed do not necessarily represent those of PACMAS or the Australian Government. It is produced and distributed in partnership with Radio Australia and networks across the Pacific, including Radio New Zealand Pacific, MBC Papua New Guinea, Palau Wave Radio, Capital FM 107 Vanuatu, FBC Fiji, Samoa National Radio 2AP, and TBC Tonga. Consider starting a conversation with your family, your community, your co-workers, and think seriously about creating a go bag. We want to help you make the next disaster less disastrous. Thank you to our guests, correspondents and contributors, government and non-government agencies who provided emergency and disaster information and support. And thank you for listening. My name is Aaron Carney. We'll be back soon with another episode. In the meantime, please stay safe, share what you have learned here, and together we will help get the Pacific prepared.